From WBUR Boston, I'm Sheila Cast, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. His plays were masterpieces of the theater, his work compared to Tennessee Williams, Arthur Miller, and by some, even to Shakespeare. Playwright August Wilson died this week at age 60. His death stunned people who love theater, especially those in his hometown, Pittsburgh, where many of his plays are set. Wilson won 2 Pulitzer Prizes, a Tony Award, and 7 Drama Critics Circle Prizes. He drew a passionate following. Audiences loved his decade-by-decade storytelling of the African-American experience in the 20th century. It's not gushing to call his work epic, and Wilson could remember the exact moment when his epic career began.
I started my career April 1st, 1965. I was like 20 years old, and I wrote a paper for my sister in the Robert Frost Carl Sandburg. And she sent me $20. I went down to McCarran typewriter store on Liberty Avenue and bought this old Royal typewriter and brought it home and plumped it on the kitchen table and said, I'm a writer.
This hour, On Point, the life and legacy of August Wilson. You can join the conversation. Were you an August Wilson fan? If you weren't familiar with his work, have you learned something about him this week with all the news about his death? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Stanford University is Harry Elam, chairman of Stanford's Department of Drama. He wrote a book about Wilson's life that was published last January. Also joining me from New York is Ben Brantley, the chief theater critic for the New York Times. Welcome to you both.
Welcome. Thank you very
Thanks
much
for having us.
Tell me, let me start with you, Ben Brantley. What is it that separates Wilson's work from other African American playwrights?
Well, I think it's what marks him as a playwright, period, is his extraordinary ear and feel for language and sense of the mythic, sense of historical context. He operates on a scale that very few contemporary playwrights do. In that sense, I think his breadth really is Shakespearean in terms of richness of language and breadth of scope.
And I'm not quite sure I know what you mean by that phrase, operating on a scale that other playwrights do.
Well, I think plays, by and large, I mean, there are exceptions, notably Tony Kushner with Angels in America, but plays tend to have become miniature, much more domestic in focus in recent years. There is an experimental drama. You may have more open-ended works. But Wilson worked in a saga, really, the 10 plays which chronicle the African-American journey through the 20th century. Are so expansive, reaching out, not describing not only the eras in which they're set, the specific decades, but reaching back to the origins of Africans in America, back to the first slave ships. The breadth in that sense, the historical breadth, I think, is staggering.
Professor Harry Elam, your book, The Past is Present in the Drama of August Wilson, was just published this past January. Let me ask you the same question. What sets August Wilson apart from other playwrights, in your view?
Well, I want to pick up on some of the themes that Ben mentioned. One is the idea of language. And with language, what he was able to do is to find power and poetry in black vernacular. So he took the language of sometimes uneducated, sometimes illiterate people and makes them incredibly powerful, beautiful things, speeches that you remember. Also, just his shaping of character. He was really, really effective in taking people and making them speak alive, real, incredibly funny, vibrant on stage. And when I said humorous, his plays were also both humorous and also touching and deep. And Ben talked about the way that the plays reached a variety of different levels, and they worked on levels that were symbolic, reaching beyond. They worked on levels that were touching and empathetic, touching you on levels as just as being a human being. And they also worked on levels that were political and touching on the dynamics of what it meant to be Africans in America over the decades that he wrote about. So he worked on all of those different levels. And that, yes, reaches beyond to a sense of scope of what we could call epic. And in that way, he was able to touch people, not just African-Americans, but African Americans perhaps particularly, but touch people cross-culturally in the type of themes and the way he expressed the experiences of the characters that he dealt with.
One thing about the language, of course, is I remember the actor Charles S. Dutton once saying when I interviewed him, he said, "We've never met anyone who actually talks like an August Wilson character." And what he does, as you were saying, he does take the vernacular, he takes street slang, but then he converts it into a cadence that's, it just sings on stage, even in speech. And I think he's Shakespearean in that way, too.
Sheila, if I could add to that, that's exactly right. So some actors are better than others at playing August Wilson.
Right.
And to that end, what he's created with his language is something that is Shakespearean, just like Shakespeare has a cadence that is particular. Mm-hmm. And that's true of August Wilson's plays.
Mm-hmm. Well, he actually worked as a poet before he considered himself a playwright, correct?
Right.
He did.
Right.
Now, Professor Elam, you just mentioned some actors are better than others at playing him. You played at least in one play, correct?
Yeah.
Why do you laugh when I say that?
I played in the second production of Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. This was back when I was teaching at the University of Maryland back in College Park, and I played the stuttering Nestor, Sylvester, the nephew of Ma Rainey, and August Wilson came down to see it.
Give us just a thumbnail of what Ma Rainey's Black Bottom is about.
Ma Rainey is the play that first came to Broadway and brought him success and also brought Charles Rock Dutton success as well. And in this play, it concerns the legendary blues figure Ma Rainey and her band. And the dynamic plays out between a confrontation between Ma and Levy, her trumpeter, who Charles Rock Dutton played, and in the latest reincarnation on Broadway, Whoopi Goldberg played Ma. But it's a play about how blacks have had to, in 1927, had to deal with the race music industry and what was expected of them. And it's a play, too, about Levy's struggle, in a sense, to find himself and to find his voice and identity in a way, and the forces that limit that growth and development.
And I interrupted you. You were about to tell us about what it was like to be a character in that play.
Well, for me, it made me realize that I didn't want to and shouldn't be an actor. It was fun. It was fun in some ways because the play was a hit in D.C. at the Studio Theater and ran for some 12 weeks, which tells you about the success of Wilson there and many places. He was the most produced playwright in the country in the 90s. And for me, I had to stutter, and sometimes after the production, people would come up to me, black women in particular, and say, "Let me hear you talk." And I would explain to them, "No, I really can talk. I don't stutter." But what happened during the course of the play was August Wilson came down to see it. And this, I think, and Ben Brentley can speak about this and knows well, too, speaks to Wilson being not only a playwright, but into the collaborative process of theater, someone who really wanted to see how plays work and be involved with the play from the beginning. So each of his plays, as he wrote the 10 plays in the cycle, were plays that he wrote and rewrote, working with actors, working with directors, particularly his relationship with Lloyd Richards, who directed the first 6 to come to Broadway. And that relationship really helped him hone, shape, change. So the play, as they began in one place, like they might begin in Boston at the Huntington, by the time it got to Broadway through a sequence of other theaters, it was quite changed and honed and refined, and it spoke to him wanting to collaborate with actors. One story on that is with his play Jitney, which is his play of the 70s, which he wrote and rewrote. He wrote early before Ma Rainey, but then rewrote later as part of the cycle. And an actor said to him in a later rehearsal that this doesn't sound like an August Wilson play. There's no monologue. So he went back and wrote one. And that idea of being able to work with actors and work with directors is part of the gift and genius and this collaborative nature of August Wilson.
Ben Brantley, can I infer from what Harry Elam said that August Wilson was a commercial success?
Unfortunately, no. I mean, a couple of the plays, I think, it made their money back on Broadway. But Generally, it's very hard for serious dramas, especially dramas that are longer than 90 minutes, to do well on Broadway these days. There's just not a huge audience for them. They were always succès d'estime, and we critics always eagerly awaited an August Wilson play because it would give us something to respond to. And again, just to luxuriate in that language was always a treat. And I think he brought out the best in a lot of actors, gave them some roles with juice. But especially in recent years, I can't say the plays were a commercial success. No.
What was your favorite play of his?
Joe Turner's Come and Gone.
Why? Tell us about it and tell us why.
It's, I suppose, the most musical of the plays. I don't mean literally in terms of song, but it crystallizes the Wilson theme of, which I believe you alluded to earlier, of people trying to find their voice. And this is the tale of a man who had been picked up after the Civil War. This is in the early 20th century, picked up by a man who would prey on the black men and women moving from the South to the North and effectively keep them in bondage as workmen. This is a man looking for his lost wife and also looking for what's in him, a man who's been so scarred and is so angry and trying to get past that and find the music within himself. And he does in two extraordinary sequences.
We're talking this hour about the life and legacy of playwright August Wilson, who died this week. Did his work teach you anything about the experience of African Americans in the 20th century? You can join the conversation, 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Sheila Cast, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Sheila Cast, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about playwright August Wilson, the African-American playwright whose masterful storytelling won him 2 Pulitzer Prizes. What's your favorite August Wilson play? Did his work touch you in some way? You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. With me from Stanford University is Harry Elam, chairman of Stanford's Department of Drama. He wrote a book about Wilson's life that was published last January. It's called The Past is Present in the Drama of August Wilson. And also joining us from New York is Bent Bratley, the chief theater critic of the New York Times. And now joining us from Pittsburgh, Michael Chemers, assistant professor of dramatic literature at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. And with him is Abby McFarlane, a student in the acting program at Carnegie Mellon. Welcome to you both.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Hi.
We're certainly glad to have you. Professor Chemers, most of Wilson's plays were set in Pittsburgh. Tease out for us what was special about that. What is it we see about Pittsburgh?
Sure. August came from the Hill District in Pittsburgh, which has a very brilliant history in African-American culture. It used to be a center for jazz musicians and theater artists of all kinds. When August was growing up, and his impact on this city has been, I mean, it really can't be measured. He's one of the, I think now, one of the most famous and one of the most celebrated Pittsburghers.
But aside from being celebrated, what kind of impact would you say he's had on the city?
Well, I think that he found a way to make the lives of, I mean, not just specifically, I've been listening to your other guests and their wonderful comments on his impact on African-American culture in general, but he was giving a voice very specifically to a very tight community here in Pittsburgh of African-Americans and giving voice to that particular experience. And I don't know where else exactly in the theater that voice is heard.
Now, you have brought with you, as we said, Abby McFarlane, who is a student in the acting program, and Abby, as I understand it, you were prepared to read for us. I'd like to ask Professor Chemers maybe to set up for us where we are in the theater. It's from the play Fences, and tell us what we're going to hear.
Certainly. This play, Fences, was written in 1985, and it was August Wilson's first Pulitzer Prize-winning play. It's a very powerful play and performed all over the world now. And the first selection, which is from scene one of act two of the play, Abby's character, Rose, has just discovered that her husband of 18 years, Troy, has been having a long-standing affair with another woman, and that that woman is now pregnant.
I've been standing with you. I've been right here with you, Troy. I got a life, too. I gave 18 years of my life to stand in the same spot with you. Don't you think I ever wanted other things? Don't you think I had dreams and hopes? What about my life? What about me? Don't you think it ever crossed my mind to want to know other men? That I wanted to lay up somewhere and forget about my responsibilities? That I wanted someone to make me laugh so I could feel good? You're not the only one who's got wants and needs. But I held on to you, Troy. I took all my feelings, my wants and needs, my dreams, and I buried them inside you. I planted a seed and watched and prayed over it. I planted myself inside you and waited to bloom. And it didn't take me no 18 years to find out that soil was hard and rocky and wasn't never gonna bloom. But I held on to you, Troy. I held you tighter. You was my husband. I owed you everything I had, every part of me I could find to give you. And upstairs in that room, with the darkness falling in on me, I gave everything I had to try and erase the doubt that you wasn't the finest man in the world. And wherever you was going, I wanted to be there with you, 'cause you was my husband, 'cause that's the only way I was going to survive as your wife. You always talking about what you give and what you don't have to give, but you take, too. You take and don't even know nobody's given.
Abby, thank you. Ben Bradley, let me ask you to relate that to what you were saying about his language, August Wilson's use of language.
Well, I think that you see an incredible musical swell sort of rise and fall in that that is like an operatic aria. But also that August could take a metaphor and spin it out to that extent, the idea of something being planted and growing and nurtured, and then turning it, well, to the universal idea of how everyone in love to some extent sort of blinds oneself and hopes that the other person is the ideal that you hope, but then making it very particular, too, in terms of these two people's lives. And as Harry was saying earlier, he works on so many levels, and you get so many levels going on simultaneously within that one speech, which was so beautifully read.
Harry?
It was. And just picking up on that, think of the character's name, Rose. Mm-hmm. And Rose talks of earthly images of planting and seeds and that idea. And so he uses the name and the metaphor there in terms of her character, because in the play what happens eventually is Rose, after this, is going to bloom in a different way, away from Troy. Also, the idea of planting a seed, she literally impregnates Troy, you know, with the seed of hope that doesn't bloom. And it talks about her power in the relationship in a way, too. So it's incredibly imaginative and powerful what he does with language. And, yeah, the reading was great and brought back that wonderful moment. It's heart-wrenching, that scene in which Troy admits the affair and Rose responds.
Abby, what is it like to bring these words of a playwright like that alive?
Oh, it's amazing. There's something about his words that just hits me. It's in a very guttural way. You know, I think that he provided a voice for African Americans, yes, but he also, more importantly, he exposed the American society. And so to have the opportunity, I guess, to say these words and to kind of like, you know, bring to life what was actually going on in the time.
Do you think you'd be studying acting anyway, or is his work part
of it? If not for August Wilson?
Yeah.
I think I would be studying anyway. I don't know if there'd be quite as many roles to play, but absolutely, yeah.
I was reading an article, and I believe it was the New York Times, by Mr. Brantley, just recently. I think it was this week, where Mr. Brantley, you were saying that his language was very much
sort of an overtone of Bessie Smith and and these beautiful blues and jazz traditions. Mm-hmm. And that really came back to me when I was listening to Abby this time reading this, that you can really hear that, those rhythms, that beautiful plaintiveness in that particular speech.
Let's ask it.
Just quickly on the blues. He says he discovered the blues while listening to Bessie Smith back in 1965, and that all of his plays are in fact blues plays, and that he would listen to the music in terms of the writing of the plays. And I think that you can do exactly what Michael suggested and go back and hear those rhythms, the blues notes, and also the sense of blues as theme, that it, the tragic and in a sense the comic dichotomy of blues as a way of survival survives in the music of the language.
Well, there's that great quote from Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, where Ma Rainey says, "Why white people don't understand what the blues are? It's a way of making sense of life."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you do, what is it? You don't sing to feel better. You sing to understand.
Well, let's see. I've got it right here. It's Ma Rainey says, "White folks don't understand about the blues. They hear it come out, but they don't know how it got there. They don't understand that's life's way of talking. You don't sing to feel better. You sing because that's a way of understanding life," which I think is a marvelous distinction.
And applicable to August Wilson's work.
Well, of course, yeah. It's about making sense of chaos, finding patterns in sorrow, misery, injustice, and... even when the plays end tragically, there's triumph, I think, and transcendence in the poetry.
Let's ask Abby to read for us again. And Michael Chemers, would you again do the honors of telling us where we are in the play Fences at this
point? Sure. Now, this is from scene 5 of Act 2 in Fences. This is the last scene of the play, and it's many years after the selection that we just heard. Rose is on her way to bury her husband, Troy. He's passed away between scenes. And their estranged son, Corey, has come back to Pittsburgh after joining the Marines, and he doesn't wish to go to the funeral. He's very torn up about it because in previous scenes we've seen him fight with his father really, really bitterly, and he doesn't want to acknowledge him now. And Rose has been raising the daughter of the other woman who we learned about in that previous scene. The lead into this is that Corey tells his mother, "I don't want to be Troy Maxson. I want to be me."
"You can't be nobody but who you are, Corey. That shadow wasn't nothing but you growing into yourself. You either got to grow into it or cut it down to fit you. But that's all you got to make life with. That's all you got to measure yourself against that world out there. Your daddy wanted you to be everything he wasn't, and at the same time he tried to make you into everything he was. I don't know if he was right or wrong, but I do know he meant to do more good than he meant to do harm. He wasn't always right. Sometimes when he touched, he bruised, and sometimes when he took me in his arms, he cut. When I first met your daddy, I thought, here is a man I can lay down with and make a baby. That's the first thing I thought when I seen him. I was 30 years old and had done seen my share of men, but when he walked up to me and said, 'I can dance a waltz that'll make you dizzy,' I thought, 'Rosalie, here is a man that can open yourself up and be filled to bursting. Here is a man that can fill all them empty spaces you've been tipping around the edges of.' One of them empty spaces was being somebody's mother."
Abby McFarlane reading a scene from August Wilson's Fences. I'm Sheila Cast. This is On Point. Let's hear from Pamela calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hello, Pamela. Pamela, I'm having some... Hello?
Yes?
Pamela?
Yes.
Glad to have you with us. What are your thoughts?
Well, I didn't have a question. I just wanted to make a comment, speaking to your guest point about August Wilson's language. And I remember the first play I saw of his, which was Fences. I remember being brought to my knees in just the fluidity and the way that language moved back and forth between those characters. And I remember thinking to myself, this is better than seeing a ballet, because it just flowed through you and around you. And I would hear that language for weeks afterwards in my head as I was going about my day. And I also was so touched with the universality of his message, and yet it was so specific to the characters on the stage. And I was so sad. I remember thinking at intermission, I thought, you know, I rarely go to plays where I really am going to lament the ending of this play. I just kind of wanted it to go on and on. So I just wanted to say that I have felt so honored to know his work, and I'm very saddened that we have lost a wonderful, terrific American playwright in a time when American theater is in such turmoil. That's all.
Pamela, thank you. Thank you for calling. Harry Elam, do you think lots of people feel that way?
I know I do. I think that one of the things that we have to remember and celebrate is that he completed the cycle. And this was something in comparison to Eugene O'Neill, the great Eugene O'Neill Nobel Prize-winning playwright, that he was unable to complete the cycle that he set out to do. And so this was a singular effort that Wilson, as he began playwriting with the cycle, by age 60 had done all 10 plays. Radio Golf, which played most recently in L.A., will get to New York sometime this year. And on October 17th, Monday, a new theater will be named after August Wilson. And so his legacy will endure. And these are plays that are going to be plays that last through time.
Ben Bratley, tell me more about what you think, how his legacy will play out, August Wilson's legacy.
Well, as Harry was saying, the extraordinary, almost mystical timing, as befits the canon of August Wilson, that he was able to complete the cycle before he died, gives such a symmetry to it. But to have that complete body of work, and the plays do speak to one another when you read them, going back to the language and what the caller was saying, it's wonderful to experience in a theater, but he also is also, like Shakespeare, one of those playwrights that when you read him to yourself, you can hear it. It turns into music in your mind as you're reading it. So I don't think these plays will ever die. I think as long as there are readers as well as actors and audiences, that music is going to be heard, and that's the greatest legacy a playwright could leave.
Harold is calling us from Quincy, Massachusetts. Hello, Harold.
How are you?
Fine. And you?
Okay. This is very good to hear this. I'm not a very literary person, and I don't attend too many live performances at plays, but I'll tell you, this is about a spirit that's going to live forever with us. August, in my opinion, is probably one of the great historians of Afro-American culture here, and I think I saw his play, The Piano, and it was televised a number of years ago. It was an amazing conflict between the selling of this legacy of an old piano and between a brother and a sister, and they wanted the money. And I'm basically an old jazz hipster. When Charlie Parker and Thelonious Monk touched me inside in 1951, I realized that there was a language in our culture that had eluded me because of my ethnic background. And he is one of the gifted ones. This August Wilson sings his song, and because he comes from that gift of spirits, he'll be with us forever, and we'll miss him, but Bird lives, August lives, and I think you know where I'm coming from.
Harold, thank you very, very much for your call. Michael Chemers, some critics say not much goes on in an August Wilson play, that there isn't enough drama because the plot is so subtle and interior. Do you think that's fair?
Oh, I think that's a pretty weak criticism of this work. That's certainly not something that I could get behind at all. I feel Harry mentioned seeds. These is a recurring theme in his plays, of seeds being planted and sprouting. And a critic recently, Andrew Sofer, said in a recent book that he thought that the seeds that sprout in Fences and in another play, King Hedley II, were the seeds that were planted by Willie Loman in Death of a Salesman. And I think this is what Wilson has been able to achieve, especially with these 10 plays, is something that Wilson struggled with and that John Galsworthy struggled with and a lot of playwrights writing around the turn of the century all the way back, is can you have a tragedy of the common man, by which I mean a tragedy of an American. And because Aristotle had said that, you know, part of the tragedy is the fall of a high person. You know, it has to be a king or a prince. But Wilson achieved that, I think. And I know this is a controversial thing to say, but in my opinion, he achieved it better than any other American playwright.
We're talking about the Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright August Wilson this hour. He died this week at age 60. His legacy lives on. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Sheila Cast, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com, and Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
This is On Point. I'm Sheila Cast, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. I'm talking this hour about August Wilson, the Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright of Fences and The Piano Lesson, with some interesting guests from Stanford University, Harry Elam, chairman of Stanford's Department of Drama, who wrote a book about Wilson that was published this year. From New York, Bent Bradley, the chief theater critic for The New York Times. From Pittsburgh, Michael Chermers, assistant professor of dramatic literature at Carnegie Mellon University. And with him, Abby McFarlane, a student in the acting program at Carnegie Mellon. Let me throw out, I guess, perhaps to you, Harry Elam. We've made some references, but haven't really talked about August Wilson's advocacy for an African-American theater. Can you give us a thumbnail of what he did to make that more of a reality?
Sure. As I mentioned, he was the most produced playwright in the 90s, so that in itself gave a voice that hadn't previously been there in terms of African-American theater. But he was someone who felt it important to speak about it as well as to express it in his writing. So famously in 1995, he gave a speech to the Theater Communications Group at their annual conference talking about the need for more black theater. And this speech galvanized some, angered others, but became the subject of a national debate. It played in terms of an actual debate on NPR that was moderated by Anna Deavere Smith and featured Robert Brustein, excuse me, and that was in January and then of 1996, and then it culminated perhaps in 97 in March in a summit, National Black Theater Summit, that was held near Dartmouth College up in New Hampshire in Golden Pond, where 300 people got together and thought about the future of black theater. So it was something he was committed to in putting words into practice in this way and in a variety of ways. So he was someone who his work was shaped by a political commitment to say something about African-American experience, but to say that this was something that we needed to celebrate in ways, but also needed to protect and also to further, so that there was a tradition of black theater that followed him and was along with him.
Ben Brantley, what is the strength of black theater today?
There are different voices. Someone was asking me yesterday, do I see an obvious successor among African-Americans to August Wilson? And the answer is no. I don't know of anyone else who's working on that scale with that kind of reach. Susan Laurie Parks, I have enormous respect for, but it's a much more experimental voice, a much more deliberately fractured voice. I think Harry might be better addressing this than I. I tend just to look at plays individually as opposed to their being part of a body of literature by an ethnic group or sexual identity or whatever. And for me, August Wilson is top of the list by any category.
I'd like to bring in, from Santa Cruz, California, Tricia Rose, who is professor of American Studies at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Her expertise is 20th century African-American culture. Hi, Tricia.
How are you, Sheila?
Fine. And you?
Good, thanks.
Is there a legacy of August Wilson that goes beyond theater, beyond the stage?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think it's very important to fully understand the depth of his contribution in theater, and the brilliant Harry Elam and the extremely talented Bent Bradley is really helping us see the depth of that, and also Michael Chemers. I'm I want, though, to see if we can think a little bit more broadly, too, because I do think that he represents this really important capacity that we haven't always had in American culture, and that is to see the universal struggle through the particularity of African American life and individuality. And that is to say that there are universal truths and experiences about human beings, sufferings, conflicts, dramas, but we always see those through some particular lens. And the ability to recognize that universality through the humanity of black people is actually a very political activity, meaning we may not be intended to be political, but it has enormous political consequences, because one of the ways in which the history of race and racism has functioned is to produce a simple, stereotypical, non-complex, instrumentalized conception of black people, where their humanity and their full complexity is rendered moot and mute to the mainstream environment. So his capacity to garner such support from the listeners who called in, to actors and actresses and people who are brought into the theater by him, is a very important process of a much larger project around humanity and communication.
Professor Michael, yes?
Yes. I just wanted to say that resonates particularly with my experience. I came to the theater as a very young person in Salt Lake City, Utah, and growing up from a Jewish background in Salt Lake City, Utah, I was feeling pretty alone a lot of the time. And when we began to confront August Wilson's work in the theaters that we were that I was a part of there, particularly Fences, we had to bring in actors from outside the community to perform these roles. And it really began to open my eyes, not only towards the social phenomenon that Trisha is talking about, the struggle can be, I don't want to say universalized, but I can find things that resonate with me very, very strongly, even though I'm not from that particular community. But also the power that theater has, the particular power that theater has, to express these ideas to a wider audience. And August Wilson's audience by no means was limited to African Americans. It was extremely wide, and I would say now worldwide.
And Brent Bradley, how open do you think the theater going public is?
I think real theater goers, people who go to the who love the theater, are extremely open. If the language is there, if the drama is there, if the intensity is there, I think the audience will be there, although it's certainly a more limited audience than it used to be. One thing going back about the universality of it is I think Wilson in his plays was also very wary of black culture being co-opted or appropriated by white culture, by the sort of monolithic structure on top. You certainly saw that in his last play, Radio Golf. These are people who are turning into essentially white entrepreneurs, and it's a the lesson of the play is you don't want to go there because you're going to be lost. Your own values are going to be destroyed. So I, at the same time that we can empathize those who are not African American, can empathize with the suffering of the people and the loneliness, and few people write better on post-coital loneliness than August Wilson does, I think. There's also always the sense of this being a singular ethnic thing as well that does have to be kept not pure, because it's going to keep evolving, but should be valued on its own terms.
Jason, right, Jason is calling from Waterloo, Iowa, with, I think, a question for Abby, our actress. Hello, Jason.
Hello, how are you today?
Fine.
Good, good. My question is, first of all, just out of curiosity, I'm curious whether or not Abby is an African-American student.
Abby?
Yes, I am.
And why?
My second question is, being that, you know, just from listening to you talk, I can tell that the way that Mr. Wilson writes is not normally the language that you would speak in. Do you find it difficult to do these types of pieces, being that it's a language different than what you normally speak?
I don't think anybody really speaks the way that August Wilson writes. Like, I mean, I am African American, so regardless of how I talk, he still speaks to me. I still can identify with these words.
So it's not difficult? I mean,
no.
Of course, acting takes energy and focus. I'm not saying it's easy, but you don't feel like you're overcoming a hurdle to get to
Into his life. Not at all.
Thanks, Jason. Tricia, you were about to say
something. Yeah. Well, actually, that of course gave me a whole new line of things to say. But let me just go back one moment to this question of universality. I wasn't certainly claiming that in any way we should not stay attuned to the particularity. I wanted to remake this point because I'm making the argument that it is holding on to black particularity that is so important in this process. In other words, it's not getting rid of black particularity. It's saying through this genuine recognition of the complex humanity of black people, I can then see all of us as part of a various set of communities and societies and world human exchanges. So it's not so much, and this is a real struggle for the U.S. I mean, this happened to Lorraine Hansberry. I'm sure Harry can speak eloquently to this. You know, the ways in which her story got understood is, oh, this isn't about the Negro experience. This is everyone's story. And I want us to stay attuned to the fact that it is deeply about black culture, and it will never not be about black culture. But that is not an exclusionary comment.
No, exactly.
That is
a
particularity.
Right.
So that's something, right. It's that struggle that I think is so difficult for us. But back to this vernacular point that Jason made, I mean, this is, I think, a struggle for all actors who have to grapple with particular dialects, but I think this is a class issue in the theater. When you articulate a particular dialect or vernacular that you may or may not have been raised in, how comfortable are you in that, and what are the racial cultural expectations? There's a particularity around this notion of authenticity in blackness that may come up for many theater goers who are looking to see themselves particularly, and I think it's an important problem we should think about.
Dorothy, I'm sorry. That's all right. Go on.
No, I was just going to say, in relation to the two things. One, as Tricia said, that she mentioned Lorraine Hansberry, who wrote Raisin in the Sun and was another black playwright who died too young, she said very famously the idea that the way that you get to the universal is through the particular, and that's what she set out in Raisin in the Sun to do. And in terms of the sense of the vernacular and Wilson in thinking about it, I mean, while perhaps people don't talk like that, he drew in so many ways from the speeches that he heard every day on the street growing up. As Ben Brantley said earlier, he had a great ear for that. And so there are things that become repeated in the plays that become part of Wilson's speech, the way that he phrases, I ain't taking no more draws, or I ain't studying you, that reappear in the plays.
I want to hear from Dorothy, who's calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Hello, Dorothy.
Oh, hi. How are you? What a wonderful show. I guess there are a lot of things that I could respond to about August Wilson, but in particular, and I don't want to presume to say August Wilson should have written this or would have written this, but ever since the hurricane, I've thought of him every day, every day. If anyone could have told this story, like not during the hurricane, but in some city far away 10 years from then, 20 years from then, when you've lost your home and the circle of people you know, and you're working, in some office or on some farm or some factory, he was the one who could have told that story best about, any number of people from the diaspora, and I would have been interested in seeing how his characters were. And as I said, it's kind of silly of me to think that way.
No, it's a wonderful thought, yeah. Dorothy. Thank you. Professor Chambers, what do you think about that idea that August Wilson would have had material in our current events?
Well, this came up in a class that I was teaching the other day, and one of my students remarked that he was surprised that the people were talking about the issues of race and class inequity in America even before Hurricane Katrina. And I was a little surprised by that. I thought, wow, really? Haven't you been paying attention? I'm sorry. I was moved by what your caller had to say.
I think
I can pick up on that. In the sense that when you have a Shakespeare production today, you make contemporary relevance in a variety of ways. You may set it in Bosnia, for example, to speak to about crisis there, or in Hamlet. So in terms of Wilson, I think the play that Ben Brantley mentioned as being his favorite, it's also August Wilson's favorite play. Joe Turner is a play that speaks about dislocation, being separated, removed. I'm not able to touch, in a sense, that history of being removed from family and wrenched in a way. And this is a play that will speak to, in some ways, those issues of Katrina. Race and class are themes that are inexorably tied to all of his plays, and in particular, Radio Golf now speaks to a black middle class that he hadn't spoken to before. But so what I would suggest to the caller is that we can take his plays, and contemporary productions will have some resonance of contemporary situations. So even as Ben Brantley said way back at the beginning, even as these plays are set way back when they're set, it's what they say to us now. It's a quote from Baldwin, who said, "We act our history, we make our history. History is the now." Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that Wilson very much understood. So even as he's talking about these past events, he's talking to our world, our now, and thinking about the conditions of contemporary America, and in particular, as Tricia said, the particulars of African-American experience in the context today.
And Tricia, absolutely. Do you think, even though we don't have August Wilson here to teach us lessons, that we will continue to get lessons that apply to unfolding events?
Oh, I absolutely. And I think what's so wonderful about that caller's point about Katrina is that Katrina represents a natural disaster version of a long legacy of very complex kinds of separation and community fragility, and in some cases engineered community destruction. And Pittsburgh, in particular, was a really wonderful ground for that problem, because it was such a rich and intergenerationally sound urban community that through so-called quote-unquote urban renewal was quite fragmented. And to have those bonds separated in various ways across many generations is really a hallmark of both the power and the tragedy of black life. And so he will, I think, always be a very important voice for that, and people will be able to use him as a model for grappling with those separations, those intimacies, the fragility of the bonds that I think are shaped by these structural circumstances.
What would any of you suggest for people who are just learning about August Wilson? What's the best thing they should do right now?
Read the plays.
Read, I would say. And then
produce. Automatically. As I said, it's something you can read in silence and still hear the music in your head.
I want to thank all of you. Chief Theater Critic for the New York Times, Bent Brantley, Assistant Professor of Dramatic Literature at Carnegie Mellon University, Michael Chemers, and one of his students, Abby McFarlane, and Professor Harry Elam, Chairman of the Department of Drama at Stanford University, and Tricia Rose, Professor of American Studies at the University of California in Santa Cruz. It's been an interesting conversation and a lot for us to follow up on with about playwright August Wilson. Thank you all.
Thank you very much.
On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Eileen Imada, Stefano Katsonis, Matt Lieber, Mary Moore, James Ross, Christina Russo, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Matt Odette and Angel Coselli. Our senior producer is Joe O'Connor. I'm Sheila Cast, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.